This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Well, it is a great pleasure. Before we speak to Professor Edima Luka about African Review peer mechanism, let's just wrap up some of the comments that came through in reaction to the interview we had with Dr. Sam Motsonyane, starting with Rendani Q Ntangeni. He's saying, what a great interview, sweet and short. And also, who tweeted us, that is Andile Nkosi. There he's saying, good interview. We need more of these convos with our elderly heroes and heroines. Of course, that's the whole aim there. And finally, Philip M, Philip Mutau, replying to Murio Muriano, saying, Tate Murio, can this conversation be available as a podcast, please? So, technical producer, you hear it. Podcast, that's what they want. Professor Maluka, good morning to you. Welcome to Power.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me.
It's been a long time.
In fact, many years, I think.
Exactly, yeah. Many years. And I was saying, you know, I'm not sure whether I was boosting or so, but I was saying, I'll be talking to Dr. Maluka, the man of action, because when we were in the 2010 Legacy Committee together, you were heading it, and I know you had some proposal that wants to be done, but there was too much bureaucracy, and he said, I can't stand this thing. If we can just sign off on the basics, but now when we come to bigger projects of this legacy, and I think you decided to go. Is that how you operate, Dr. Maluka, that you want to see action and progress?
I think sometimes it's the best way to do it. Of course, it was difficult then because there was no clarity in the legacy framework, who was supposed to fund what.
We
came up with our legacy program thinking that it would be financed by FIFA or from the FIFA budget, and FIFA said no, but it was a South African initiative, government should fund it. So me and Danny, we went to see government, and government said, at the time it was Brastov, said we'll have a small budget here, and once the budget was in government, then government officials implemented it, so we ended up with no budget at all. So I had no budget, just had ideas and program, and of course, it was a good experience, but I had to go.
Yeah, well, indeed. And Kuli, I'm not sure if the mic is probably set up there, so just wanna make sure. All right, guys, this is Professor Eddie Maluka. We're gonna look at the African peer review mechanism. You know, and I just want us to get to the basics, because when you know, the issues of African Union, the issues of African Parliament, now this African peer review mechanism, there was a time, Professor Maluka, when they were in the spotlight within the country. To be honest with you, during President Thabo Mbeki's term, we will understand this. There were a lot of things the way this we could hear, because even in his speeches talking about being an African and driving the agenda and so on, but it seems as if after that has dissipated a bit. But before we get into the South African perspective, I just want us maybe to get to the basic. What is African peer review mechanism in the context of the African Union?
No, thank you. You know, a few years ago, you are right, during President Mbeki's time, President Mbeki put together a small team, and I was fortunate to be in it somehow. And the purpose was because he was of the view that Africa needed its own program, economic program. And there was a team which was led by Professor Nkutlu, and I was in that team.
Westman Nkutlu.
Yes. Yeah. And and that's how NEPAD came about. That's why when it was operationalized, Professor Nkutlu became its first and inaugural CEO. But then when the initial ideas around NEPAD were that NEPAD, it will be an economic program, but membership into NEPAD will be based on certain governance, compliance requirements of some sort. That was the initial idea. But once NEPAD was integrated fully into the African Union, because the process was running parallel to the shift from the OAU to the African Union, and the African Union was launched in 2002 here in South Africa in Durban, then NEPAD was integrated fully into the African Union, and it was of course put under the African Union Pan-African structures. Then there was a feeling that no, but we still need a separate body where members join voluntarily and subject themselves to reviews and to sharing experience, things that necessarily, by being an AU member, ordinary member, you don't necessarily have to undergo. And that's how the African peer review mechanism. So it came out of NEPAD. It was created out of that, and President Mbeki himself was so instrumental to it with President Obasanjo and others. So the idea was that there must be a forum in Africa where leaders can sit around the table and talk directly and frankly to to each other. Okay. It was created in 2003, and it's headquartered here in South Africa, and that's where I am now.
Okay. All right. Now, in terms of the main purpose, leaders can talk to each other directly and freely without too much bureaucracy, but what are the key focus areas in terms of what are the exclusive issues that these leaders can discuss about that are outside the African Union, or it doesn't really work that particular?
No, we have a methodology because countries can't review themselves because it's a multilateral body. So, and countries can't review them. Of course, they created a secretariat, a continental secretariat. That's where I am. Mm. But they then said, we'll also create a panel of eminent persons who will review us and put together a report. Mm. And then when we meet this panel will then present to us a report of their findings.
Yes.
And then the president of the country's concerned will then respond. So that's the methodology we use. So for example, my job as the head of the Continental Secretariat, like now two countries are going for reviews now, which is Egypt and Niger. So there is a panel of eminent persons. They are meeting on Wednesday. So we have already started the process in Egypt. We are also in Niger. We are going to deploy Pan-African teams of experts for about 2 weeks in those countries.
Okay.
And they work with the lead panelists. There is the panel, they allocate countries among each other. So there's a lead panelist for Egypt, there's a lead panelist for Niger. Mm. And then they will go there, they spend 2 weeks, they meet with everybody, they meet with anybody, they open any doors, and they put together a report. And then so the president of Egypt and the president of Niger in January at the summit of the APRM will then receive their reports, and then they will then have to respond. And then the other countries will take the floor and make some suggestions and other things.
This is very interesting because you mentioned an important point. Countries can review themselves. Mm. That's a governance principles of checks and balances. Exactly. Now, what I'm interested in, Brian, is that it must be a minefield because a country has a lot of things. I mean, starting with the ministries, and countries differ. Have you managed to find some kind of a consensus criteria that you are using to say what do we monitor so that we can have an extensive review? Have you got a
We focus on four thematic areas.
Okay.
Democracy and political governance. We focus on economic governance. We focus on socioeconomic development. This is really the issues about poverty, what government programs you have about to fight poverty, women and youth and all of that. And then fourthly, corporate governance, how you organize the corporate, the private sector, how it's governed, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. So, and we have a questionnaire. And the methodology we use actually is that we send a questionnaire to a country. Like, for example, the question of Egypt was Egypt then will receive the questionnaire. Mm. They will administer it themselves because countries that are members are supposed to create or establish APRM national structures.
Okay.
So that's why they call our office Continental Secretariat, because in our member states we have a country. So when I go to our countries, we have our APRM staff. We have our APRM staff. Mm. They consider themselves part of the secretariat.
Yeah.
And they are in their countries, they are independent of governments.
Yeah.
They are the ones who then do the initial work. They produce what you call a self-assessment report.
Okay.
So they will produce a self-assessment report, and then it will be sent to me. Yeah. And then when I receive it, I inform the panel. We now have a self-assessment report, and then we start the process then of deployment of our team. So the team, its point of departure is what they can. So you mark yourself first based on the questionnaire around these four thematic areas and say, this is what I think. Mm-hmm. And then they come on a validation. But the final report is done by the panel. And not even the lead panelist. The lead panelist develops it, takes it to the entire panel, and the entire panel validates it. So it belongs to the panel. And what is good, which I can say, is that we encourage to countries. Countries are not defensive when the reports are put forward. There's been one or two instances where a country was so defensive, the president, at the time it was a prime minister.
Mm.
But in most cases, the presidents, they may not be happy with everything. But I remember one president said, what can I say? But it's the mirror. Should I break the mirror? I can't.
It's the mirror.
Yes, that's what the mirror is telling mirror. About myself. Yeah. I don't like what they're saying, but what can I say? I must accept it and just commit myself to say, look, we need to work on these things.
That's the spirit. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, the issue of the mirror. I'm going to hone into it, but also I'm going to just focus on some of the issues that have been brought about by Dr. Mo Ibrahim, especially relating to governance, to see how African peer review mechanism work with the Dr. Mo Foundation after this break.
Thank you very much.
Refreshing and stimulating talk. Power 98.7. Now we're talking.
Well, indeed, we are in conversation with the Continental Secretary of the African Peer Review Mechanism, Professor Eddie Maloka. You know, the last time we were together, he was the doctor. Now he's a professor.
Don't worry. It means nothing, to be honest. It means nothing, to be honest.
Yeah, well, he's humble. I know that. Okay, let's come to, and by the way, guys, you can, you know, the lines are forever open throughout our show, as you all know, on 0861-987-000. You can also contact us through our social media platforms at PowerFM987 using the hashtag PowerWeek, or you can tweet me directly at Murillo Muriano. Let's talk about the mirror metaphor. Here's the president. You've done your assessment through your through your national office. They've brought in that. They're meeting at the leader summit. You're presenting to the leader. The leader who says to you, Professor Maloka, I've received this thing. I don't really like it, but it's like the mirror. So should I break the mirror? Let's talk about people like President Yoweri Museveni, the man that I admire so much when he was still on the ground fighting for the liberation of Uganda through his National Resistance Army. And from time to time, he's still in power, he's still in office, and they do it by changing the constitution. And some analysts, political analysts, Professor Maloka, are saying they're committing what you call constitutional coups. I don't want to put you into the spot, but if people are changing constitutions to stay in power for years and years and years, does your peer review mechanism tackle those issues head on?
No, let me talk about President Museveni, because his report, I think, featured at one of our meetings. And I was impressed by how he handled it, because he was not happy with his report. But in his intervention, he responded to specific ways. His report was touching on a number of things that were challenges, because in our reports we say best practice and the challenges. And he responded, but he said at the end, I commit myself, my government will do everything to implement the findings and so on. But at night, his protocol, they started looking for me. So I'm seeing all these calls. I was in Addis Ababa. Yeah. I don't know these numbers. It turned out that his PRISM 7 is protocol. He wanted to meet me. So it was at night. I went to see him. And then he was telling my brother, I'm not happy with the report. And then he started with his team engaging that, look, here and here. Then I said, President, what I will do is that I will send a team to Kampala to work with your team and try to talk more about these issues that we are raising. And I'll also inform the panel. That's what I did. And I've since spoken even publicly about it in Uganda at some public event. He was there. I was commending him for that. But as to how is the question you are raising is how do you get change thing, how do you change things in the African Union?
Mm-hmm.
What in the African Union we agree is that if a leader has lost an election and he doesn't or she doesn't want to leave, that constitutes an unconstitutional change of government. So there is a procedure and a process to follow. So the Peace and Security Council of the African Union will have to consume. But if a government changes its constitution constitutionally, there is no provision for that.
Mm-hmm.
But then what has happened then is that President Museveni, you can talk about other countries on the continent. There have been instances where countries' leaders' term, maybe in terms of a particular constitutional arrangement, comes to an end. But then there is a constitutional process, and then the country goes into a referendum, amends its constitution.
Mm.
In the AU, you have to work with the constitution of the country. But let's say we say that's not a good practice.
Mm-hmm.
We have to start another track. And there are a few things that we are encouraging now among the leaders. Because we are a multilateral body, remember.
Yeah.
We are not an opposition group.
Mm-hmm.
We are a multilateral body. We are working with our member states. We are employed by them. So this is what they have agreed. Unconstitutional change of government, this is what it entails.
Mm-hmm.
But we are also their advisors. If we say, let's say, changing constitution, in whatever way they are changed and to do certain things is not a best practice.
Yeah.
So there is a track already on that. So we try to get countries to have a conversation on that. And also there is a track also on elections, because elections have become a source of instability on the continent. So when countries go to elections, it's tense. People are fighting. Sometimes we don't accept the results. Sometimes this and so on. But we work with them. So our methodology is different. We work with countries. So when we think there is a best practice in a particular area where they don't agree, we try to get them to agree. And once they develop the guidelines, the agreement, then our job then is to go to them individually and work to them then on the domestication on those undertakings. So this issue has been discussed quite extensively on the continent. But until there is a decision in the African Union addressing it, we must continue to work to build consensus among member states of how do you deal with situation where a country maybe has a constitution that limits term of office, but maybe in some countries or a party, they think that they still need their leader more and they change. So how do we deal with that? So it doesn't fall under unconstitutional change of government, but in some cases you may say it's not best practice, but we need to work on it to try to build consensus among countries that may perhaps deal with it this way. That's why our processes are very slow. Sometimes some people may think that we are not doing much, but that will be our methodology and approach to dealing with this matter.
And I think it must be a tough one, because you're dealing with sovereign states.
Exactly.
And like you say, you are not opposition.
Yes.
You are there to support, to promote good governance, to promote democratic principles and so on. I just want to look at these two contrasting views or countries, because I spoke about Uganda with President Yoweri Museveni. People have been complaining in terms of economic development, there's lack of progress. And then you come to another president who also initiated constitutional changes, Mr. Paul Kagame in Rwanda. Everybody's raving about Rwanda. It's, you know, doing business in Rwanda has been done well. The cities are clean and, you know, there's all these kind of things. So, but that's the very same thing. Some people are saying, we can understand that President Paul Kagame has changed the constitution, you know, so that he can remain in power. But at least he's doing something progressive about that. In those instances, how does your barometer work?
No, of course. We look at the country in terms of, it's also even how we look at election monitoring in Africa.
Yeah.
When we send election observer missions, let's say SADC and or the African Union, when you look at the outcomes of an election, when to say it's free or fair or what, we don't look generally at some, we normally use the constitutional provisions and the laws in that country.
Yeah.
So when you look at Rwanda, you look at Uganda, you have to look at what are they saying in the constitution and so on. But if there are things in the constitution that are not in the best practice, like for example, the best practice we encourage is that the national human rights bodies must be independent and they must be constitutional bodies or strongly protected by legislation. But in some countries, they are appointed by cabinet. So in such countries, we engage them. We try to say, yes, but your appointment, why don't you give them an independence? So that's how we work. That's we go into a country, we do an analysis, and then we work with a country. We try to sell to that country a best practice. That's why we also create, because we are doing the PLNE, to say, look, in this other country, this is how they do it, and so on and so on. And then perhaps you may not, I know you've been to Kampala many times, but I can tell you that Uganda is doing it's doing quite well. You know that what they have done now is that they are focusing on infrastructure. They have built the Kampala and Tebe Expressway. They are now going to start the exploitation of their oil resources in 2022. The country is going in a different direction. So it's changing. So somehow you should also give a little bit of credit to what the leadership is doing there, but they have a different sort of problem. You got in Rwanda, of course, they also have their own challenges, and President Kagame has done things in a particular way, but there will be differences even among opposition groups, among political groups in the two countries, etc. But our work is to work with what the countries say, and if there's a best practice the country is not observing, we try to sell it to that country and even bring other countries together and say, look, in Nigeria they are doing it this way, in this they are doing it this way, why don't you learn from them? And then the countries say, we have learned from it, then we even send teams to say, no, go there, and then they work with you, then they can then see how. So that's how so we don't go into countries and antagonize countries. I do that, I'll be out of my job in a few months.
You facilitate.
Yes. facilitate, you encourage,
based on best
and then you sell best practice to other countries, and you try to use your persuasive skills and diplomatic skills somehow to try to take to encourage countries maybe to look at how others are dealing with the same thing.
Okay, I'm in conversation with Professor Eddie Maloka here, Secretary of Continental, pertaining to the African peer review mechanism. 27 minutes before midday. This is Power 987. I'm your ultimate Noxman, Murio Sanyani. We are together until the midday, and midday will be top. It will be news at top of the hour, and after that, AK Shabalala will take you on a musical trip. Yeah, feel free to engage us on 0861-987-000. You can also tweet us at PowerFM987 using the hashtag PowerWeek, or you can tweet me directly so that we can get the conversation going with the Prof. So, Prof, the other issue I mentioned before the break, it was about Dr. Mo Ibrahim Foundation. He's passionate about governance, and he honors the leaders who are doing well and so on. And there was a time where he decided, I don't recall the year, but he decided that nobody in the African continent deserves to get the award because he was not so much impressed. And in one of the meetings, by the way, he spoke about the age of African leaders. He said, guys, even President Barack Obama is 45 years and whatever. He says, African leaders wants to rule to the grave. I'm not sure, in terms of your best practice when you do these reviews and so on, especially considering that Africa is a young continent, do those conversations happen in the review processes about young leadership coming on board and things like that?
Of course. We have just established an APRM youth network. They are meeting now here in Johannesburg, and it's one of the things that they put very strong. They want to be visible. They want to be in the leadership. We had a very big youth continental youth symposium in N'Djamena in Chad on this issue. So it's a best practice, of course, but it has to happen at country level. We can't from outside come and impose leaders and say, here's a young person, take the young person. It has to happen, but it will happen eventually. It's a generation, and generations will pass. And I think that we'll see more and more, not just young people, but also women in senior and top leadership. And the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, of course, I'm quite familiar with your work. I sit on the advisory board that does the report. And and also they are our strategic partners. So I work very, very well with them. We collaborate, we exchange methodologies. But they do their work differently.
Mm-hmm.
They use experts.
Yeah. Okay.
And they do desktop research on, and then they generate their reports. We don't work that way. You see, we don't use distance. We are not distantly distant from the situation. But we are a multilateral body. They are not a multilateral body. They are an international NGO.
Right,
but besides that, their program, their reports, I think they are invaluable. And the prize that he's giving, it's a very good motivator. And I remember when he started it a couple of years ago, he even came to South Africa to consult. At the time, it was President Mbeki. It's a very good, and as to why they didn't award during that, I think it was about 2 years. It was an internal debate among themselves.
Okay.
We took a different view, and at some point I was even asked to write a letter to them to take issue with them, to say that they are perpetuating this view that there is nobody deserving in Africa who should be taking this prize. And sometimes, you know, with due respect, they are doing a lot of good work, I can tell you, but sometimes it's just board politics. Find that board members, they are dynamics and so on. Like, for example, why President Mbeki was never given this prize, it was internal board dynamics and certain dynamics that, that in fact, in my view, they were not, they should not have been a factor.
Mm-hmm.
And President Mbeki and others, they should have been given the recognition due to them for the contribution they made to governance and the fight for governance, good governance on this continent.
Well, indeed. Well, interesting stuff. Some of the things that are coming out there from Professor Eddie Maloka. Let me go to the calls. Let me start with Aaron in Rustenburg. Aaron, good morning. Welcome.
Hey, Daddy.
Yes, sir.
You know, long time ago, when Mbeki was a president in South Africa, the African peer review mechanism, they went on and reviewed South Africa, if you remember. Then their findings was that ANC is too powerful and not good for democracy in South Africa. What did they mean is that the ANC was even currently now, they're winning election freely and they're not performing. what did they mean is that at least they should lose once, maybe once in four elections. Then did ANC follow up that review report? What did they do about it? Does anybody remember? Even Professor, I asked him, does he remember that the report?
Yes, definitely. We work with it, yeah.
Aaron, you wanted to pose a question? Yeah, sorry, I think we got distracted a bit. The question is about the...
It was about the review. Long time ago, they went on and reviewed South Africa and they said ANC is not winning elections every now and all these elections, not good for South African democracy.
Yeah.
Did they do something about it, the report?
Okay, that's a question there, Dr. Maloka, Professor Maloka. What happened to that report? You know about it.
I know about the report, of course, and we have since been working with South Africa on it. I think the issues, it's really the issues around dominant parties. The ANC is not alone in that position, but it is becoming less and less dominant. It has since, of course, lost in some municipalities, etc. So at that time when the report was done, South Africa, of course, the ANC was a dominant force. So I think the whole thesis around dominant parties is that dominant parties, if the oversight within them is not strong, they tend to go in a particular direction, abuse power, abuse this. And I think it was raised in that context. And to that, if you have a dominant political party and an opposition that is relatively weak, the dominant party can ignore certain things. Unlike in a situation where, like in the United States, in Ghana, in Nigeria, where... you know that if you don't do certain things right, come in next election, you may lose power. So you are under pressure from the opposition, from the strength of the opposition. But a dominant party, then you need it internally. It has to be strong. It must have internally its own self-correcting, and it must have internally its own oversight, mechanism to be able to make sure that it self-corrects, it improves, and so on. And of course, I'm a South African. I see now what is happening in our country, and of course the ANC, I'm sure it will learn from its own experience as to what has happened.
I'm particularly curious with what Aaron has been saying, because if there is this feeling that a party that is powerful,
dominant
and powerful, might go astray, but somebody or a counter argument, Professor Maloka, might be that that party, it's not there because of its own. It's simply because of the will of the people.
Yes, exactly.
It is the will of the people. So why are we worried? Because it's the people who made that party, who gave that party a two-thirds majority, whether it's Ghana, whether it's Nigeria, whether it's Guinea-Bissau, whether it's Zambia. It's the people of those countries that give them two-thirds majority. Why should we worry?
Yes, no, of course. That's why I was saying it's just a thesis on dominant parties. It's an assumption on dominant parties. Of course, you assume that this happens in a democratic system. It's not an authoritarian regime.
Yeah.
So it's a party that has been elected democratically by a vast majority of people, but is so dominant and powerful that its re-election and future in government is guaranteed. Then it can sometimes relax its guard and start being not listening to the people and focusing more on interest of individuals, etc., etc. Unlike in a democratic setting where you know you may be out of power, you tend not to do certain things.
Yeah.
You tend so. I'm saying that in such a situation, of course, in this thinking, you encourage the dominant party itself, in the absence of a strong opposition internally, to have a very strong self-corrective, self-learning mechanism that enables it to be able to listen to people on continuous basis, to do certain things, and so on. But you know that what has happened over the years, so people now feel the ANC is no longer listening to us, and so on and so on and so on. So I think it was in that context, and it's something, it's an ongoing debate, but that was then. That the situation has changed now, as I said. And
okay, indeed. We're going to, if you can put your headphones, Dr. Maloka, we're going to go back to the reads and welcome Siyabonga. Siyabonga? Good morning. Welcome.
Morning, Rio. Let me just cut through that latter. In 2016, if I'm not mistaken, President Mbeki raised red flags the issue of foreign nationals in South Africa and how they conduct themselves in one of the meetings. So I wanted to find out what have they done about that, and what is happening in South Africa in fires the influx of foreign African foreigners. Is something that they normally that normally happens in other countries where there is a good economic growth.
Siyabonga, just repeat the one about President Thabo Mbeki. I think I missed it slightly. Can you repeat it quickly about President Mbeki? Yeah, on this issue. Yeah.
In one of their meetings, I think the meeting in 2016 when the peer review committee met.
Okay.
President Mbeki reflects the issue that in South Africa, foreign African people, they conduct themselves in a manner that impacts negatively in our social welfare.
Okay.
I wanted to find out if they have done something about it.
That. Okay. Yes. Thank you very much. And I think it segues into my brief conversation with Premier Makhura when he was coming to be interviewed by Aldrin St. Pierre on Power Talk. Before he got into the studio, we spoke about it as well to say statistics, are they having them or are they relying from Home Affairs and so on? And he says, we have these statistics and we've even sent the invoices to our sister countries in the continent to pay, particularly for the health and so on. Professor Maluka, question from Siyabonga.
Two things here. The first one is that, of course, one of the things that were picked up, came up in the South African report was that if South Africa doesn't attend to the challenges of integrating foreign nationals who live in South Africa, you'll end up with outbursts of violence, etc., and xenophobic violence. And it has since, of course, happened. And in many APRM meetings, when people talk about the examples of the early warning potential of the APRM and that countries are not heeding these calls, they sometimes use this example. So it was in that context. So they were saying you have a lot of African nationals from other African countries here, but they are not properly integrated into South Africa. So you need to take that into consideration and actively do it. If not, there's going to be infighting over jobs, over houses, and it has happened. But I don't think that the point that he's trying to make around, I don't think that it's a global problem, not even a global problem, it's a global phenomenon. There are a lot of people going to Europe, there are a lot of, the Europeans are battling with this issue, the international migration, the US, of course, you know now there's been big debates with President Trump and et cetera, on the same in the UK. So South Africa is one of the poles in the world where there is it's a reception area of this, in this, you could say, a wave of international migrants leaving certain parts of a country of the world to go to certain countries, and South Africa is one of the recipients. So we will not have a moment where we are able to shut the doors or shut the gates. It doesn't happen that way. We need innovation at policymaking level, and we can learn from what is happening in the UK. We can learn what's happening in the EU. There's a big debate in the EU, in individual EU countries, and learn. There is a way of taking good advantage, because it's not true that that foreign international nationals, they're doing bad things. It's not true. There are individuals who are bad, but most of them are professionals. They are lecturers at university. They are medical doctors. In fact, there are areas which have been abandoned by South Africans, are serviced by this foreign national. Many of them are professionals, are business people. They run bank accounts. They buy houses. They are contributing to our economy. But of course, there are those who come here. Others, they don't have skills. But even many of those who don't have skills are not necessarily criminals. They're there. They're looking for jobs. They are outside building sites. They try to come into a house, do a garden, do this, but they will always be. But to create that, this whole narrative that equates foreign nationals with crime, with criminality, bad behavior, I don't agree with it. I think it's a xenophobic stereotype. I don't think here in South Africa we should encourage it, because I don't want to be called, because I'm a South African, I'm xenophobic, which apparently, unfortunately, this is what people, when you meet us, I'm at work in a country, once I introduce myself as a South African, people say, oh, you are the people who are killing Africans there. I don't like it. It's very, 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 it's not right. We are creating this about ourselves. We create false equations, false automatic connections, which do not exist.
Let's reflect on what happened in the, especially when you talk about the xenophobic angle. Let's reflect on what happened in the Joburg CBD this past week. And remember, it doesn't only start here. We had the mayor, the executive mayor of Joburg, I call him Makhuru Major, Herman Mashaba,
yeah,
who has been on this crusade to say hijack buildings, okay? There are foreign nationals who are not in the country legally, you know, who are illegal in the country. And he has been on this crusade to try and clean up. Some buildings have been rescued back. They're going to build low-cost housing. This issue has been bubbling under. And what happened with the police and the JMPD during the week going to raid the CBD to look for counterfeit goods, which is constitutionally they're mandated to do that. Mm. And then there was a serious retaliation. You know, there was serious retaliation. And everybody from law enforcement agencies, they're saying the majority foreign nationals were the one who attacked the police, and the police had to restrain and, you know, retreat instead of like firing back or something. So, Professor Maluka, because you work into the continent, but South Africans, they phone into the programs. They're very angry. They're saying we have
no, but they are being agitated. They are, unfortunately, yeah, they are being incited by our own leader, our own leaders, because our own leaders should not be the ones putting on Twitter accounts inflammatory statements that incite people against foreign nationals and creating this impression that this foreign national... No, no, it's not such. In South Africa, we don't just have a problem of hijack. We even have a movie on this, the Bethlehem. You remember, is it Bethlehem?
No, Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, hijacking of buildings. It's a phenomenon here. Yeah. It's quite widespread. And some foreign nationals are involved, some South African. I don't know who's involved. I don't have the intelligence on it. Mm. And of course, it's an illegal activity. The police must clamp down on it. The police must also clamp down on counterfeit goods. And when you are a leader and you and the police are about to undertake this kind of operation, they will brief you. They will have done their analysis. They will have their own intelligence. And intelligence will do a breakdown and say, no, this is predominantly foreign nationals, etc., etc. But it cannot be your own narrative as a leader. That's where I disagree. I don't think leaders who should look after all of us should be going and say, oh, you are, you are a foreign national. And so no, I don't think, and to say, stop attacking our police. But this police, they are supposed to serve even foreign nationals here. So it's a wrong way, and I think it's embarrassing. I think the problem is that leaders must call for calm, must help educate our people. But our people will be angry, they will be agitated. But when leaders join in the agitation and they become part of the incitement, that's where the problem is.
On the show, just an hour or so ago, there were even calls to say, we don't see leadership in this issue. They were saying, where's the president? If your law enforcement agencies are being driven out of a city center by foreign nationals, and they say there hasn't even been a statement from President Ramaphosa, there's been a press conference or something, they said, where is leadership?
No, it should not be looked at that way. I don't think we should create an impression that there's a civil war taking place in the country between foreign nationals. You must look at it as a law enforcement issue. It's not new, it's not unique to us. There may even be armed groups that come from the same country, but you should deal with it as a law enforcement issue, issues of criminality. And you may have intelligence that says it's done by this kind of groups. It may be an ethnic group. It may be a group. But you don't, in your own narrative and approach as an authority at the level of state, and start profiling your own people. You don't do that. Everybody who lives in South Africa is entitled to care and protection from the South African state. It doesn't matter your country. And if you are doing something wrong, you must be treated the same way as a South African who does something wrong. You should not be profiled. That's why I have a problem. I think the president, I hope the president doesn't join the statements I saw coming from. It will be hurtful, because what happens when he goes to the African Union meeting, I can tell you, he's going to have to take the floor and try to explain himself, because this is a big concern on the continent. We are under attack because of pronouncements based by our own leaders. During President Zuma's time, we had to constantly explain ourselves in meetings of SADC and the AU. We were just becoming, you could say, a broken record on this topic. But that time we could explain it, because it was the government was not making this kind of... But now it's difficult when it's leaders themselves, because we live on this continent. We live on this continent. You can't, when people are doing something... And remember, illegal occupation of properties is not just buildings, it's also land. And it's not just done by foreign. Even South Africans are doing themselves. They set up informal settlements. So you should deal with this thing globally as a leader and say, this is happening, this in the city, this is the form in this, and deal with it as a policy issue and also law enforcement and so on. But all these people are our own people. Those who are disabled and those who are beautiful, those who are ugly, those who are criminals, they are your own responsibility. And you must deal with them fairly and equally and without discrimination. That's where my problem is.
It's gone 8 minutes before midday. We are all fine. The lines are chock-a-block. I'm going to ask the prof to put in the cans. I'm just going to ask you to get to the point so that we can... We've got only 8 minutes left. Let me start with Falaza in Klerksdorp. Falaza, your comment.
Hey, Murray, how is it, bro?
Your point, sir. Good.
Thank you very much. You guys are talking a lot, man.
I'm sorry, it's me actually who's talking a lot, and you are my homeboy from Klerksdorp. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, my bro. Look, I just wanted to check, what are the available mechanisms that kept the accountability? I'm talking about the states that are being peer-reviewed, because at some stage we must not fall into the symbolic kind of the compliance, but with no necessary mechanism available out there to ensure that we hold the states to account. Otherwise, we'll have the good processes in the place and we find that they are all but theoretically and symbolic. So how do we ensure that there's a proper and constant compliance? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Falaza there. Nina Kriko.
Good morning to both of you. Look, my number one point is this, and I think it's coming from a lot of listeners all the time, and I think it's a totally valid point methodologically. Your guest has said that half of the people here from other countries are actually doing good things, and they're working, and they're providing services, et cetera, et cetera. Now, one would like to know where we've got the statistical evidence for that, given that many, many people are here illegally and hidden. So the statistics are actually very, very important in terms of understanding the situation. The second thing is to suggest that all you've got to do, you know, it's simple, is actually introduce law enforcement is problematic. Because as we know, the government has not been capable of establishing a law enforcement process to address the issue. So what does one do with a state which is incapable of establishing law enforcement? And how could the public, because the public is infuriated, how could that public monitor and insist that, in fact, this process does take place and that it doesn't just drag on for ages? Any other discussion about xenophobia is incidental to the problem of how you make the state do what it is supposed to do. Thanks very much, Maria.
Thank you very much, Nina Krikol. Let's go to Eugene Pretoria. Your comment.
Hi, Rio.
Yes, your comment, sir.
Yes, Rio. I just wanted to comment on Professor Maluka's statement there. When you asked him to say that as South Africans, we are quite angry about what has happened in the CBD and in the Johannesburg CBD. And, you know, his response is that, no, we are responding as is because we're being agitated by politicians. And that is completely wrong. I mean, we don't need politicians, you know, to incite us. I mean, we are capable people. We can see what is happening as South Africans. And this problem has been simmering for a long time. So for the likes of Professor Maluka to say that we are being incited by politicians, it's really incorrect, you know. And yes, I appreciate the work that he does, but you can hear his comments that he's making, and it's purely because he's doing work in the African state. And for him to comment negatively, it puts his job on the line and his colleagues up there. And I think it's time that he needs to face reality, and we need to call this problem what it is. You know, that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Eugene from Pretoria. Matlatsi, good morning. Your comment.
Morning, Mario. I would like to find out from the professor if this board of theirs, if it is an independent board, or do you have another board which is independent? Especially, I would like to give an example for a country like Zimbabwe. Or AU have done nothing to solve the problem of Zimbabwe. So what about them? How can they try to solve the problem of Zimbabwe? Because here in South Africa, if we're talking about foreigners, we're talking of Zimbabwean people. These Uganda, Nigeria, and Egypt, where they are going to try and solve, but there are very few, just a handful of foreigners of those people from that country. But we've got a lot of Zimbabweans which are here in South Africa, and then which is making this country to have overpopulated and then to be overstressed. Okay. So is this board of theirs, is it that strong to try and push out the government of ZANU-PF? Because to me, it seems as if it's just a darling and darling between ANC or and ZANU-PF.
Okay.
Why, at least we know that MDC won the vote in Zim, but what are they doing to push out that government out?
Okay.
If democracy, because it doesn't seem there is democracy in Zimbabwe.
We got your point. I got to go. All right. Dr. Maluka, some of the questions from statistics, Nina, that were taken down. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to be very quick because I don't think it will help trying to get into a tit for tat. And we don't understand each other. And it's not true that I'm saying what I'm saying because I think my job, because I work in that space, and I the kind of things that I see South Africans doing or saying, they will help me if it was about me. And but it's not an issue at the moment. But what I think we should do, maybe with Power FM, let's host a dialogue, a public one. We had proposed to the previous administration that let's have a national roadshow and talk about this thing. And it's, I think my brother, when he was saying, I'm attributing what's happening now to leaders, he didn't understand me. I said, yes, people are angry. People could have been angered by their own individual experiences. I was on the panel of that was chaired by Halima Mutante. We go to the parliamentary panel. We went all the provinces. So people were, these things people were saying it. But leaders don't have to, leaders have to call for calm. Leaders have to lead. Leaders have to advise us, have to lead us. So I think when the problem is when leaders join in, it's a problem. All what I fear for my country is to see my country become what is happening in the United States at the moment. I've been to the U.S. frequently recently. It's sad when people start name-calling each other and start saying, you don't belong here, you belong here. It's hurtful. We were never treated that way. We lived in among our neighbors here for 30 years. We're never treated that way. Maybe we behave differently. Maybe yes. But I don't think our country should go in that direction where we stop name-calling each other, say, my neighbor is Shangan, my neighbor is Zimbabwe, and my this. I don't think we should. So we really need to have this conversation, this dialogue. And I think that I want to challenge you, and I'm my friend as well. I'm not bribing you. But on the issue of the statistics, quickly to say, it's a global stereotype.
Yeah.
To equate that says everybody who's... a migrant, yeah, there's a raping incident, it's a illegal migrant. It's just a global stereotype, and statistics have shown that. I will advise Nina to look at the statistics coming out of the International Organization of Migrants. It's just a stereotype. It's no statistical basis for that. And of course, the issues around law enforcement, what happened there, it's a challenge. It shows us what are the problems in our country. And I can't talk for Zimbabweans. I think Zimbabweans are capable enough and very proud people. They should solve their own problem. The OAU won't solve their own problem. The OAU did not solve the problems of South Africa. South Africa solved their problem. But where the Zimbabweans should start is to trust each other and support each other. And I think it's a big challenge. But in South Africa, we have, of course, we are there, we work. And I'm happy with the spirit of the intervention by my brother here. But it's primarily Zimbabweans themselves who should solve their own problem. And the APRM, of course, it's a multilateral mechanism. It's not an independent board. It's just a multilateral. It's created by countries.
Thank let's call it much. Round one because we are out of time. So our story is told. Nkuli, thanks. Snatemba Jili, thanks. Kimurio Sanyane Wabudukoshi. Ja bless. Ntantla Sume standing by with the news. It's gone midday.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.